Really? Yeah, I'm Ken Davis. Yeah. Retreat Center Director and Volunteer Coordinator for the Liebenzell Mission of Canada. Yeah. If only the salary were congruent with the title. So, thank you. Congratulations, Carl. Rugby. RSA won the rugby.
Yes, sir.
Great stuff. Beat the English. I don't care who wins after New Zealand loses. As long as they lose, we're good. Okay. I was asked by Carl not to present a paper, but to preach. And so I will try to preach and hopefully be of some good to at least some of you. This won't be an exegesis of that long text that we have just read. Mostly we'll just focus on one little phrase in it. If I were to give this sermon title, I think I would call it The First Church of Little Power. I know that you have but little power, and yet you have kept my word and not denied my name to the church at Philadelphia. Okay, so you are the pastor or a member of the church in Philadelphia. Your church is not very big. It has been plagued lately by some opposition, mostly from the Jewish leadership in that town. They are telling lies about you. People seem to be believing them. Your church is struggling to do whatever it can in obedience to the call of Christ upon it, but it has been, and it continues to be, hard. A Christian businessman calls you to ask you some questions about your church. His company has offered him a promotion, and he has been given the option of moving to any one of three cities where his company has offices. His company's offices are in Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea, and he is checking out the churches there. He has heard incredible things about the church in Sardis. It's alive, it's hopping, it's ministry, it has ministries for the kids, the community loves them, pastor has a call-in show, he gets thousands a day, and his blog gets all kinds of hits, and it is the church of just what's happening now. Laodicea has a church with a pastor for every need known to humanity. They can hire however many pastors they want because they are very wealthy. Their budget is bursting at the seams, and their biggest need seems to be just getting someone to manage all their rich resources. The city finds them respectable. The city leaders approach them for advice on local matters of importance. And this businessman has called you to see what your church is like. So you tell him, we're not big. We're not very influential. We have a little power, but very little. There's a group in the city that are telling lies about us. They're opposed to us. They seem to be having some influence. We've lost a few people lately. Some of them find all the ministries in Sardis very attractive. And so they drive there. It's not that far. And he's a decent chap, pastor there, but seems to be wavering a little bit. And he thanks you and hangs up. Where's he going to go? What church is that man going to go to? You have a reputation for being alive, he says to the Sardisian church. Or the church says, we are rich and have need of nothing. Or the church that is small and persecuted and not doing that great, as we count greatness as greatness is measured. You know where he's not going to go. And it will be likely he will go to one of the other two, move there. I mean, we get this account of Jesus and he tells them what they're like, but that's the average person doesn't see deadness. It doesn't see self-reliance. It doesn't see poor, pitiable, naked spiritually at Laodicean church. They see a church that's hopping. Philadelphia is wedged between Sardis and Laodicea geographically. Sardis seems to be doing so well. It's a wonderful reputation. Be very attractive to those searching for a church. So would Laodicean church. Big budgets, lots of ministries, and in between them is you. Philadelphia church, weak by human standards, persecuted, it's having troubles, not attractive to outsiders. And the one who looks upon the heart and not mere outward appearance has nothing good to say to either Sardis. The only good thing you can say about Sardis, you know, there's a few in there that haven't bought into whatever has caused them to be dead. There's nothing really good said about the church, and there's not even a few good ones in Laodicea, according to what Jesus says. They're just dead. They're just poor and blind and pitiful and naked. That's what Jesus sees. And so, you know, none of us pastor mega churches. None of us pastor great big churches, as bigness is counted. And the point here is not that all churches with great reputations and lots of money are bad. There are big churches with lots of money that aren't bad. And I'm not trying to say that all little churches are good. But this little church was good, and these two big ones were bad. Good reputation is not necessarily a bad thing. The Sardis church has a reputation for being alive. Not necessarily a bad thing. One of the requirements of an elder is that you have a good reputation with those who are outside. The issue is not a matter of reputation. The issue is what gives you the reputation that you have. Daniel had a reputation of being a pretty good guy. His reputation was so good that when his enemies wanted to do something about it, the only thing they can do is make prayer illegal. That's reputation. That's what you want. And it seems to be the point with Jesus to all seven of these churches, that the ones doing any good at all have opposition, persecution, or some kind of nonsense going on inside it, or from outside it. And there's only two that have no bad things said about them. And what do we read of them? Smyrna, verse 9. I know your tribulation, your poverty, but you are rich, and the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. The devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested. For 10 days you will have tribulation. Nothing bad said about them. The only bad thing is what's happening to them. To the other church that nothing bad is said about. I know that you have but little power, and yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say that they are Jews but are not. Isn't that very striking? Same thing in Smyrna. Behold, I will make them come and bow down before your feet. They will learn that I have loved you. Because you have kept my word about patient endurance, I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world to try those who dwell on the earth. So the two that have nothing bad said about them are the ones that are suffering the most. A striking thing. Out of the seven churches, the two that are the least attractive to us are the ones that are the most attractive to Christ. Now, I'm not addressing people here. You're not wondering what church you should join. I'm addressing you people here who already serve in churches. And all of us in this room know the struggle of pastoring in Philadelphia. And I don't believe that any of you can stand up and say, we are rich and have need of nothing. Nor do I believe that you ever would, because you are people who know what really matters. You know that money deceives and it's a false god. You would never say, if God should bless you with a lot of money, we have money, and therefore we do not need anything else. I'd be shocked if any of you came to that conclusion, if God ever should land money on you. Nor would you be satisfied with mere reputation. You're not pastoring or serving in your church in the hope that you can win the praise of men, although that's a constant thing. I don't know if I've ever started to preach without praying that that wouldn't be the reason I'm preaching. You know, I don't want people to hate it, but I don't want to do it just so they'll like me or like it. You are not aiming the attractiveness to the world at the expense of real, deep, solid spirituality that comes out of the Word of God, which comes from God Himself. But none of that means that it's easy to serve in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is hard to serve in. And there are times when we want to convince God Himself that we will remain faithful even if we can say, I am rich, Lord. I keep telling the Lord that if He gave me millions, I would use it for Him. And He constantly seems to not believe me. But even as we minister in Philadelphia, we need a word of encouragement from time to time to remind ourselves that we are doing a valuable work, that God is pleased, and He doesn't look at the outward appearance. You have a reputation for being alive. You are rich and have need of nothing, but you do not realize. The Laodicean church's problem is not their money. The Laodicean church's problem is their ignorance. You do not realize that you're poor and blind and pitiable. It's their ignorance. And so we serve in Philadelphia. We feel like we're serving in Philadelphia. And we know that money's not it. And we know that reputation's not it. And yet, it's still hard. This little meeting is a valuable, valuable thing where we are right now. Because serving where we serve, 98% of the people I meet and I tell where I work, they can't even pronounce the name of the place. I mean, Liebenzell's mission's goal, it seems, is to be to travel under the radar. You know, nobody knows about us. Nobody knows about you. And we gather here, just a few of us, now and then. I come now and then. You come more regularly than that. We absolutely need each other, because if you never leave Philadelphia, you're going to get hurt. You are going to start to waver, because we just need each other. I believe that the church is defined, and you can argue this with me later. I think Acts 2:42 is normative. It's not just a statement of history. Those who believed and were baptized devoted themselves to the apostles' doctrine, to the fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and to prayer. I believe the breaking of bread there is the Lord's table. You can argue that with me later too, if you want. But devoted to the Word of God, the apostles' doctrine, the breaking of bread, the fellowship, and to prayer. We are devoted to the Word of God. We are devoted to prayer. We want theological soundness in our celebration of the Lord's Supper. Are we devoted? Are we devoted to other people, to one another? Because we will not survive without the apostles' doctrine. We will not survive without prayer. We won't survive without the table. And we most certainly will not survive without each other. We're not made to do it. Hebrews 3, pointing this up, John Piper says, I only have one message. I'm just going to keep preaching it till you get it. And I feel like that. I may have said this to you before. I don't know. But Hebrews 3, 12 and 13, see to it, brothers, that no one has a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God. Well, how do you do that? Next verse. But encourage one another daily. No, that can't be it. But that is it. Encourage one another daily. As long as it's called today. That none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Hebrews 12:12 says, therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees. And in the beginning of Hebrews 12, the writer to Hebrews, almost said Paul, the writer to Hebrews, he starts with this race analogy. Run the race that is set before you with perseverance. And he gets to verse 12, he's still in that race analogy. Therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees. So this is a guy, that sounds like a marathon to me. He's running a marathon. And Your hands start to droop, your knees get weak, and you start to wobble. And somebody come, you know, and the passage here is, lift up your hands. But I'm the one who can't lift up my hand. And he's quoting from Isaiah 35, verse 3 and 4, where it says, strengthen the weak hands, make firm the feeble knees, say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. So he's not saying to the runner, lift up your own hands and strengthen your own knees. Can't, I'm running. He's saying to other people, lift up their hands, strengthen their knees. We can't do it. It is hard to pastor and serve in Philadelphia. And we can't do it alone. We need the Word of God. We need prayer. We need a proper understanding of the Lord's table and get the benefits that God has designed for us to have out of it. And we must have, be devoted to the fellowship. I don't think that the pastor in Sardis woke up one morning and said, I'm going to kill this church. I just wanted to die. I don't think he did. I think, I mean, my speculation, I know, this is not exegesis by any means, right at this moment, but the Word of God became to him a thing to teach others. It's become his textbook. The hardest thing I found about the Bible while I was pastoring, well, I'm still pastoring, the hardest thing for me is not to go into it, to give it to others before I seek to have it feed me. What do they need? What do they want? Well, you know, brother so-and-so, yeah, I know just the message for him. Right? And we can preach it and not have it go through us first. And so it becomes our tool to use. And the warnings of Scripture to the leadership at Sardis no longer apply to them. You know, examine yourselves to see whether you were in the faith. I don't need to do that. I'm the pastor, for goodness sake. Warn. You need to worry about whether you're in the faith. This is not written to me. And yet Paul will say, beat my body, lest I be disqualified. And we will write books and reams and articles and preach sermons on how this cannot mean that he was concerned for the security of his own soul. I think it was. I think it's a mark of a Christian. But it's not for me. I don't need to worry about that. And the church grows. And the Sardis church gets big. And they have a reputation for being alive. And the Laodicean church grows, and it has more money than it knows what to do with. We must be on the right track. And then there's you and me in Philadelphia in the middle, wondering what in the world we are doing wrong. Why doesn't God bless us like that? And so Jesus writes them, speaks to them, sends them this message. And he is the one to the church of Philadelphia who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, and shuts and no one opens. And in the very next breath, Jesus says the same thing again to them. I am not just the one who holds the keys of David that can open doors that nobody can shut and shut doors that nobody can open. I am the one who does that for you. I know your works. Behold, I have set before you. I open doors, and I have set before you an open door, which no one is able to shut. It's for them. He repeats it so that the church will know that it is for them. I hold a door open for you. The churches around you have large, rich ministry. They're buzzing. And they're just doing great guns. And so Jesus comes to the Philadelphia church and reminds them, I'm the one who opens doors and shut doors. I can remember saying to my wife, I went plant a church in St. John's, Newfoundland, and they stayed away in droves. I remember saying to my boss was the treasurer of that church. He calls the relationship we have now his revenge. But Remember, we were going out Sunday afternoon to visit door to door, and he said to me, I think we should change what we say at the door. We should now ask, which church is it that you don't go to? Because they all say, I belong to such and such a church. Actually, we went one morning, and it had snowed Sunday morning, and we had visitation that afternoon, and we were going to the house, and the snow was on the ground, and there wasn't a mark on the snow anywhere, and she said, I go to St. Mark's. I said, were you there this morning? And she said, yes. I said, okay. We don't need to deal with anybody that can float to church, right? Don't even make a print in the snow. They stay away in droves. And I remember saying to my wife, what am I doing wrong? Maybe we need, how should I change my dance at the door? A major thing in making me a believer in the doctrines of grace was that experience in St. John's, Newfoundland. Because I believed it was up to me. What do you do? And that's the temptation when you're pastoring in Philadelphia. So Jesus comes to the church and says, I hold the key. I have opened the door. Nobody's going to shout it. Shut it. And it's up to you to walk through it. It's not about how well you dance. It is about how long I keep this door open. And Moses says to God, I can't speak. And God says, oh, right, I forgot about that. Called the wrong guy. What does he say? Who made man's mouth? The 2-hour cartoon, Prince of Egypt. Not a theological treatise. But at the burning bush, when Moses says, I can't speak, there's a bellowing out of the bush. Who made man's mouth? It's a great little scene. It's worth watching. Who made man's mouth? This is not about you. I don't want to go. This is what his last excuse is. I don't care. You're going. It's about him. I have given you an open door. And the opportunities that you have in your Philadelphia church are given to you from Christ to take advantage of. It is not for us to wish that we were buzzing with activity and ministries like others. We have no idea what Christ's assessment of them is. It may be good, maybe not. It may be as bad as Sardis's. And if you are serving a church of Christ, know this. He has given you a door of opportunity to walk through. You read the commentaries. I don't know. Who was the guy at Dallas Seminary used to say that his students were educated beyond their intelligence? And I read some commentaries and I think about it, and, oh dear, I had 3 or 4 commentaries looking through this and what's the open door? And it's missions. No, it's not missions. It's an open door. God opens a door. Go through it. What is it? Go do it. It doesn't matter how big you are. It doesn't matter how small you are. It doesn't matter how much money you have. You are in a church and I have given you opportunity. Walk through it. It is not for us to say, I'm not as big as Sardis. Oh, I forgot. I can only use churches that are dead, who seem to be alive. Christ has opened the doors, and he knows better than we do. I want a better door. I want a bigger door. I want a door of reputation and fame and influence. On Friday, I washed 4 toilets and made beds. So that people could come in, and it took me. I said, I gotta preach on Monday, and I gotta preach on Sunday. So I had a sermon ready for Sunday, I had a sermon ready for Monday, and here I am cleaning toilets and vacuuming floors and cleaning the kitchen, and the group didn't come. What are you doing? Lord, what's this about? None of your business. Open door. Well, I got a group coming tomorrow, and it's all clean, so I don't have to worry about it. So there you go. I want a better door. I want a bigger door. And isn't it odd that God keeps not giving it to you? I keep telling God, if you do this, what a servant I would be. I say, yeah, you leave that up to me. I believe there's such a thing as evangelical prosperity gospel. It's not what you think. The prosperity gospel is, you know, you have enough faith and God will make you rich and healthy. And you don't have to worry about that kind of thing. And eventually you'll become a staff member of Trump's, you know. Isn't that great? The evangelical prosperity gospel. And it's amazing how many good men have this. You get into this book and you preach this book 16 ounces to the pound and you will grow a significant church. How much, do you preach heresy? You must be. You're not getting a big church. That's prosperity gospel. And I can list you two or three of the big guys that we like who have said this. You just preach the word and you'll grow a church. So I preach the word. And a man said to me, I think the only reason God's got you in the pastorate is to show to you that you shouldn't be there. That's not what I was told would happen. But then you go to the little church and my executive minister, and of course Convention Baptist Church, we all expect better out of them, but he says to me in New Brunswick, I'm in a church of 30 people, and he says, Ken, after my induction service, this is not a bad church to climb up from. I said, shame on you. If this is where God has placed me, this is the door. What are you doing? This is your door. Oh, dear. I don't want to get dunked 7 times in that river. Take me to a better river. Let me get healed there. Oh, the little girl says, you mean where it's nice and comfortable and big and fancy and famous. So yeah, that one. What stops me from bearing the fruit that God has for me is my desire for other, better, bigger, more famous. And the point is that the little churches we are serving in is the greatest thing in the world. It is an honor beyond comprehension to be allowed by God, who does whatsoever he pleases, to be allowed to lead 30, 20, 10, 50, 200 people into faithfulness to Christ. I preached in a little church yesterday that has some serious problems, and they're declining and getting smaller and smaller, and I fill in there from time to time. And there was an African lady there yesterday, one of the 20 or so people that was there. And we were having a Bible class after church. And she said, is it possible to lose your salvation? Well, you know, just throw this sovereign grace guy a bone, would you? You know. And so we started. And there was another guy there. And we were tag teaming on her. And she comes up after me after the meeting yesterday. And she said, let me tell you what I grew up in. And she tells me the things that she was taught in her church growing up. And she said, this lesson this morning has absolutely fed my soul. Mm-hmm. One woman. Now, do I leave that place and say, come on, God, I want more than that? I floated out of that room. holy smokes. Holy smokes is a bad thing to say. I just floated out of there. God put me in that room with 10 people, and there was a woman there who's been told that every Sunday she has to come to church, and they have two places you can walk. You can walk down to this part of the front of the church where you've never been saved before, or you can walk down this part of the church where all the people who were saved last Sunday and got lost this week have to go. She said, I grew up with that, and I was never happy, and I was never satisfied. I never knew if I was good enough for God. And she said, what you gave me this morning has been so liberating. One woman. I served in St. John's Newfoundland for 5 years. To the best of my knowledge, we had 3 converts. Planting a church. What a waste of time. There are 3 people. One of them is certainly dead now, because she would be about 120. She was about 80 when she was saved. I'm preaching in his old folks' home. And I didn't mean to get into storytelling, but here we are. And I was preaching, and she raises her hand. I said, don't do that. We don't do that here. She raises her hand. This is an old folks' home, so I stop. I know she might be having a heart attack. I said, what? She says, I want to be a Christian. So I'm not done yet. No, so we stopped. We sang a hymn. And I went and sat down next to her. And she said, in 1942, my husband was going overseas. And after he left, I found out I was pregnant. And I thought I was sure he wasn't going to come back. I already had some kids. I don't want to raise another one without a father. So I had an abortion. She said, can God forgive me for that? She said, that and all the rest. And I gave her the gospel. And she was converted. She was an Anglican, never got baptized. What a failure. I don't. If I go to heaven and I meet 3 people in heaven who are saved, my life is not a waste of time. Why would God take me from Toronto? It's a 40-hour trip to St. John's, Newfoundland, by car and boat. And put me there. And that's where the man told me that I was only there because God didn't want me there. And stay there 5 years. And now the church doesn't exist. And by every standard of church planting and church ministry and church success, I was a complete failure. And the president of our denomination came to visit us one time and said, we look forward to the day when you will be the premier church of Newfoundland. Why? Because that's the prosperity gospel. Spiritualized and made to look healthy because the good guys hold to it. I want bigger and better. But the little church where I am serving, the little church where you are serving. I wrote my pastor last week and said, I don't know if I can continue to lead the seniors ministry given my schedule. And you want panic. He wrote back with all kinds of panic. But so we need to pray in a heart that breaks with joy just over the immense privilege that he has given us to do what we are doing. Walk through the open door. Nobody's going to shut it because Jesus opened it. And it will not be shut until he shuts it. The open door is there despite all appearances to the contrary. The church of Philadelphia, they couldn't see the door. They could see Sardis, and they could see Laodicea. They couldn't see the deadness of Sardis, but they could see its reputation and what that garnered for them. They could not see that Laodicea was wretched and pitiful and poor and blind and naked, but they could see that they were rich, needing nothing. And that's part of our problem, and we need to see with the eyes of faith that God gives us. Jesus addresses this church, and it's the church of Philadelphia that has not wandered. And maybe you're a good pastor in a struggling church. There was he died this year, a baseball player, pitched for the Yankees, named Jim Bouton, or Bouton. It's boutin' in Canada, I guess, bootin' in the U.S. B-O-U-T-O-N. He wrote a book called Ball 4, which is just a frightening book about the immorality and debauchery of sports lives when they're not on the field. And then he wrote another one called I Coached Good, But Boy Did They Play Bad. I said, there's a pastoral theme. Maybe you're a good pastor in a suffering church. You're coaching good. They don't always play good. There are times when the troubles in my little churches make me not to be as Philadelphian as I should be. I am 65 years old. My father died at the age of 80. That's 15 years. I get 20 of them. I get an extra blessing from God to go on. Heather says I'm going to make it to 90 because she's the one in charge of my eating, but I know how to disobey. If the wounds of the pastorate were visible, that would be a horrifying mess to look at. And how I wish that an older pastor had stood up in a meeting when I was 24, 25, and said to me, God's opened a door. Go in it. Nobody's going to shut it. Don't let anybody challenge you unless you are living a life of secret disobedience. Unless you are not sincere. Unless your faith is not real. If you are struggling to be holy and you are following Christ, don't let anybody stop you from going through the doors. And guys, do you encounter young men wanting to pastor? Or who are starting to pastor. Seminary approached me and said, would you just come? Would you just come once a month and sit in the cafeteria and just talk to these guys? Just to encourage them. Who do you know? Let them know this. They are not aiming to be a church with a good reputation. They are not aiming to be rich and have no material needs. They are aiming to see what door God has opened so that they can walk in it and do what God has called them to do. This is our calling. God has something meaningful and powerful and significant, but we need to let God define powerful and meaningful and significant. We don't get to tell God what our ministry should look like. If he has called us, he will open a door for us that no one will shut. And we are to go through it and serve Christ. It may be that we serve him in smallness or obscurity. It may very well be great fame and worldwide influence, but it's not likely. It may be that we will leave this earth without anyone saying that we did great things. But whatever our path is, if we overcome through all the trials that this ministry is and serve Christ with little power, because the most dangerous thing for us is if we are superiorly gifted and very powerful. And if we serve him in our little power, then we can know that he will keep us safe in the middle of the trials and he will make us a pillar in the temple of his God. This is the promise to Philadelphia. He will make us a pillar in the temple of his God. And never shall we go out of it. And Jesus will write on us the name of his God and the name of the city of his God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down from his God out of heaven and his own new name. That's the promise of the Philadelphia church. That's just too good to be true. Except, it's true. I wrestled a long time whether to read this next thing to you, because I wrote, I've wrestled with this all my life. I say to my wife,
I want to matter. And my problem is I measure it wrong. Measure it wrong.
Is ordinary sinful? He wondered in his heart. Is it wrong to travel faceless in this world and not be part of something grand and glorious, of movements brave and bold that answer to the crying need of masses young and old? Is it wrong not to head up that thing that grips the need of a dull and lifeless world of men with a dull and lifeless creed? But just to keep on plodding with nothing but a call that does not ask for greatness but will not let you fall? Is it wrong not to be last, to speak about a matter and silence all who dare to speak and bring to naught the clatter? Is it wrong to not have gifts to organize the mass, to have all of the answers in before the questions asked? To see into the souls of men deep down under their skins and make your listeners marvel at your insight into things? Is it wrong to not be able to read a book a week while tending to some dirty sheep with strength that's oh so weak? To plead and pray and try so hard in things beyond your ken, stirring up some souls for God to make them better men? Is it wrong to have your life revealed, to know it now for sure that you are not the superstar you always knew you were? Is it wrong to mourn such things, and is it sinful pride to have the knowledge cripple you and rip your soul aside, but still go on like nothing's wrong, pretending you are in with others who have done so well, all hidden in a grin? It can't be wrong. Oh, please say no. It's just the way things are, to want to lead with all behind and grip men from afar. It could be worse. You could believe that you led flawlessly, that you were extraordinary, and they too blind to see. Ah, oh, boy. Not wrong to be little. Not wrong to work in Philadelphia. Go through the open door, whatever it is, and may God give us the grace to do so. And get back, just in closing, find some young men who want to be pastors and counsel them. Nobody ever came to me and said, "You're not a failure." That was the second last thing. The last thing is this. I was at a group of church planters in a meeting once. And the guy got up. He just started to cry. He was supposed to give a report. He just started crying. He burst into tears. He was uncontrollable. He said, "I'm such a failure." He knew that when he went in there, there was going to be revival, and it didn't happen. And I marveled as the pastors gathered around him to console him. And they said, "It's okay. We love you." Nobody said, "You're not a failure." Because they believed he was. Because he didn't get the numbers. He didn't get the revival. Let's work in Philadelphia. Let's go in the door. Do what God has called us to do. Pray for fruit. And hear God's well done. God bless you.